orielbrushworkspainting.com. Chance of rain tonight, steady temperatures in the upper 30s, then drizzle and fog early tomorrow with gradual clearing. Highs 37 to 45.
Hello, I'm Neil Coxall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Big ticket item. The British government says it has had enough of wild resale markups for tickets to concerts and games. We'll hear from a campaigner who spent years trying to end the price gouging madness. He says the ticket now is making sure the legislation actually gets passed.
And Umami Mia. It may have originated about a millennium ago, but apparently its handlers feel it hasn't yet had its time in the spotlight. Because an Italian consortium has just announced that Parmesan, you know, the cheese, has been signed by a Hollywood talent agency. For real.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few moments here on KAXC. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. And at 7 o'clock, Mike Berry, your volunteer host for On the River. Right now, we are going to sample our album of the week. Before we hear the set list, the album of the week's called All Hat by Joshua Headley. As a country musician, Headley has dabbled with varying kinds of country over the years. This is his tribute and love letter to Western swing. The song we're going to hear is called Fresh Hot Biscuits.
Brother, I know just the place. Puts a smile on every face. Throw that flour, knead that dough. Roll them all out, don't you roll so slow. Eat them with butter, eat them with jam. Fresh hot biscuits made by hand. She won't do what her sister will. My gal makes the best around. Bix them up all nice and brown. Throw that flour, knead that dough. Roll them all out, don't you roll so slow. Eat them with butter, eat them with jam. Fresh hot biscuits made by hand.
This is The Set List on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are taking a look at four shows this week, November 20th through the 22nd, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday in Virginia, Walker, Nisswa, and Bemidji. Starting things off with the new Iron Range supergroup Rangers at Chair in downtown Virginia. The project is led by Keith Sokola and features Rich Mattson, Jermaine Gemberling, and many other Iron Range musicians. They just released their debut album, Ranger, mixing folk, Americana, and rock and roll, this Thursday, 7 p.m. in Virginia. The same day, Duluth-based jam band Salty Dog are heading to Walker and the Green Scene Market and Eatery at 8 p.m. Salty Dog are led by Jacob and Owen Mann, who grew up in the Walker area and play a funky mix of rock, blues, and folk. They released their latest album, Pepper, in 2024. Salty Dog, Thursday night in Walker. The Grassroots Concert Series continues Friday in Nisswa with the Weary Ramblers at the Journey Church. The Ramblers are a folk duo with mandolin, harmonica, fiddle, and tight harmonies. They will be celebrating the release of their brand new album, Driftwood. It's Weary Ramblers, Friday, 7 p.m. at the Grassroots Concert Series in Nisswa. Finally, singer-songwriter Cage Jamber is playing at Bemidji Brewing on Saturday at 5 p.m. Part of the brewery's Timber Tap series, every other Saturday this winter, Jamber released a pair of singles last year called Golden Life and Kerosene, showcasing his melodic and acoustic style. Saturday, 5 p.m. at Bemidji Brewing. If you have information on live music you'd like us to know about, email comments at kaxc.org. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens.
Bridging the Gulf, Prime Minister Carney is off to the UAE. Canada's former ambassador to that country says it's about time and that there is a lot to gain from a strengthened relationship.
Bursting with enthusiasm or just bursting? Despite investor jitters, there are strong projections in chipmaker NVIDIA's earnings report. A market reporter tells us what this means for the AI boom or bubble debate.
Paying the price, the Ontario government says impaired drivers who kill a parent should have to pay child support. Our guest says that certainly would have helped his family after a drunk driver killed his son.
Acting in Concert, a longtime campaigner against price gouging, supports the UK government's plan to make it illegal for ticket resellers to extort people, provided that plan actually becomes law.
You could have knocked her over with a feather. An animal sanctuary staffer in Utah says it is not every day you get the call to help an owl that somehow got caught in a cement mixer, and knowing how to help was the hardest part.
And Grated Expectations. A major Hollywood agency signs a huge new client. Well, a huge new aged client. Parmigiano Reggiano, the classic thousand-year-old Italian cheese. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that's got you in the palm of our hand. Prime Minister Mark Carney has talked a lot about finding new trade partners. Now he's hoping to put other countries' money where his mouth is. On Thursday, he'll sit down with United Arab Emirates President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan on his way to the G20 in South Africa. He wants to establish a trade relationship with the Gulf nation, which is seen as a major player in global financial markets. Arif Lalani is a senior advisor at the consultancy firm Strategy Corps and a distinguished fellow at the Center for International Governance Innovation. He served as Canada's ambassador to the UAE from 2012 to 2016. We reached him in Lisbon.
Arif Lalani, what is success for Canada and for Prime Minister Carney at the end of this trip? What are they looking to get?
Well, I think the visit, first of all, is a success for the relationship. It's been 28 years, I think, since a prime minister has visited the United Arab Emirates. So that's one important thing. Second, I think success is probably a number of agreements on economic and investment cooperation. I'm looking to see one, maybe two concrete agreements. And then third, I think, is some kind of framework to keep the relationship growing.
And in terms of those investments, can you give our listeners a little bit more detail about what they might entail if things go according to the way the Prime Minister and his delegation plan?
And I think it's important to know that the UAE is already a very significant investor in Canada. Many people may not know that they've invested in ports in British Columbia. They've invested in natural gas in Alberta. And they've been willing for over a decade to be investing in infrastructure of the type that the Prime Minister has now announced. So I think we should be looking at investments in the energy sector. We should be looking at investments on AI and technology. We can look at investments on food security and environment and climate change. These are all areas where the UAE has intellectual leadership, but also has invested around the world and I think is ready to invest in Canada.
And apart from strengthening that relationship, what is the UAE looking for out of this visit? What does it want from Canada from this point on?
I think the UAE wants partnership. I think it's a mistake for Canadian leaders to think that the UAE is simply just a bank or a source for financial investment. I think a relationship with the UAE should be a geopolitical play. The United Arab Emirates has very good and strong and important relationships with India, with China. They're the largest trading partners with both of those countries. And, you know, those are countries where Canada is trying to rebuild its relationship. So I think what the UAE is looking for is a partnership that acknowledges that the UAE has global heft, that the UAE is leading globally on a number of areas such as AI. I mean, I was recently in the UAE and, you know, they're well ahead of Canada in terms of adaptation of AI, even development commercially of AI. So I think they're looking for respect and partnership.
There are concerns as this relationship becomes more high profile. It's already in existence, this relationship, as you've said, these ties. But as the relationship becomes more high profile, there are also more concerns as more information comes forward, certainly about, you know, the story we've been covering, what is unfolding still in Sudan, the UAE's role in that conflict, alleged support of the RSF. Our CBC News colleagues have also covered how Canadian-made weapons are ending up in Sudan, and there's concern that that is happening with the assistance or that they're going through the United Arab Emirates. So, yes, you know, even if Canadians understand and agree that Canada needs to diversify its interest, given the reality with the relationship with the United States, there are also many people who are deeply concerned about what that relationship can mean in this particular time. So what do you say to those who have deep concerns about human rights issues and this kind of involvement internationally?
Yeah, I think Canada would be right to voice its concerns. I don't think there's a problem with that. But I think Canadians have to understand that we deal with countries and have dealt with countries for decades where we don't agree with many of their human rights issues at home and globally. And that includes Western countries like the UK, like the United States. So I think people need to be careful about a double standard when it comes to the Middle East. But I think absolutely we should raise concerns where we have them. But the first step to raising concerns is to actually engage.
And knowing what you know about how these relationships are built and fostered, how would those topics be raised at this point in a two-day session like this while they're also negotiating deals? Because, you know, Canada would still want to assert its beliefs, right, while also you know, understanding, you know, what you're trying to do and what's happening there.
I've always said that there's a difference between having your say and being heard. And I think Canada wants to be heard. In other words, I think, you know, you want to have a mature discussion. And I'm sure the Prime Minister will raise it, and I'm sure it won't be the last time it's raised. And that's really up to Canada and how we manage our diplomacy. But we don't at every instance sort of raise the question of should we be dealing with them? Of course we should be dealing with them. Can we deal with them on a number of issues at the same time? Of course we can. So I think Canada needs to have a level of maturity and a level of pragmatism in dealing with the UAE as it does with its other partners.
And Ken, you know, when we talk about international profile, you talked about what the UAE might want and how it wants to be seen for Canada as well. It's long been dwarfed in terms of, you know, the international stage by the United States. So could this start renewal of this relationship, rebuilding of this relationship, give Canada what it's looking for on the global stage and maybe give them the kind of influence, give the country the kind of influence where it could move the needle on issues people are thinking about?
I think it can. You know, Canada has to acknowledge where the UAE is. Everyone is looking for investment from its sovereign wealth funds. So I think you have to acknowledge the UAE's standing in a changed geopolitical world. And I think that's why the Prime Minister is going himself very early in his mandate to demonstrate that you know, there is respect for the UAE, and that there can be a partnership to work together.
Arif, I appreciate this. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Arif Lalani is a senior advisor at the consultancy firm Strategy Corp and a former Canadian ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. We reached him in Lisbon. Anyone who logged on to try to get tickets to Oasis or the Kendrick Lamar SZA tour or the Blue Jays World Series run has experienced the sticker shock and awe. Tickets sell out immediately, and then minutes later they pop up on the secondary market at eye-watering prices. Well, today the UK government said no more. It says it plans to ban reselling of tickets above their face value. After that plan became public, shares in the US company StubHub plummeted by 14%. Adam Webb is the campaign manager of the Fanfare Alliance, which has been campaigning against online ticket touts, as they're called in England. We reached him in London.
Adam, is a decision like this, a measure like this, victory for you and your colleagues?
It's not quite victory yet. I mean, this is obviously a really important moment, but, a big but, we still need the legislation to enter the parliamentary system and become law, and we still need it to be enforced.
If those two other things are checked off and those things happen, is this measure really going to end huge markups on ticket prices there?
I think it's going to go a long way to doing that, yeah. I mean, I think the ultimate ambition, I think, is a kind of a change of market. So a switch between uncapped ticket resale. I mean, I say that kindly. I mean, okay. We're talking about mass scale exploitation on the secondary ticketing market. Ticket touts buying large volumes of tickets and dumping them on the secondary market to extract high prices versus a different kind of market, which is about capped resale, which is fans selling to fans for no more than the price they originally paid.
Yeah.
If you can't go to a show and then another fan buys the ticket.
And when you say tout, some of our listeners may know that term, but for others, is that equivalent to what we would call a scalper?
Here? It's equivalent to what you would call a scalper and what StubHub's Eric Baker would call a power seller.
Your favorite phrase, I can tell. Who wouldn't love that? What are some of the examples that you've seen just recently? I mean, certainly I think many, if not most people, have had at least one instance where they're trying to get to a show and they can't even get in at the outset. And then when they do, I mean, the markups are huge. What kinds of things have you seen recently in terms of resale?
I mean, just to illustrate, you were asking about high ticket prices. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a show in a really brilliant venue in Leeds in the north of England called the Brudenell Social Club. Quite a small cap venue, like a few hundred capacity. There's a Steely Dan cover band there, playing there on the 17th of January called Nearly Dan. And I'm looking on, and the tickets are about, you know, £22. Mm-hmm. And yet I'm looking on Viagogo and I'm seeing about 20 tickets listed, all by the same seller in Poland. 18 of them are listed for £129 each. And there's two tickets for £5,394.
This is a cover band.
It's a cover band. So the question I ask though is that why is someone in Poland trying to sell tickets for £5,394 to a Steely Dan cover band at a show that's not sold out with the tickets of £22? None of this makes any sense. Nothing on this website makes any sense.
The company, Viagogo, you were mentioning, you know, as you know, they've said that this is, the price caps don't work, that it's going to drive people to sketchier ticket yep. sellers. There's going to be more fraudulent tickets. What is your response to that?
Well, they have no evidence on this whatsoever. The reports that they quote, where they say this is the case, are reports that they've paid for. and the people and the other organizations that try to reiterate their points, they're also paying them as well. So this is very, very self-interested. We've spoken to banks in Ireland where there has been a price cap in place since 2021. They say there's been no increase in fraud over social media. We've spoken to consumer groups in Australia, exactly the same answer. I think the one thing you can safely say is that, yes, of course, there is ticket fraud on, you know, Facebook Marketplace, on social media, but that fraud exists regardless of whether you've got a price cap in place. And I think they're really going to struggle to find evidence of, actual evidence rather than the stuff that they've concocted themselves.
I interviewed on this program a while back a former CEO of Ticketmaster. He blamed fans. He said it's basic supply and demand. And if fans didn't agree to pay the prices that their favorite artists are helping to set, then this wouldn't be a problem. What would you say to that argument, which I'm sure he still subscribes to?
I don't fully buy into that argument. So if you've got some dedicated people unlawfully removing huge volumes of primary tickets at face value, and then instantly inflating those tickets and dynamically inflating those tickets, then essentially they are creating their own demand, and then they are very kindly offering to fulfill that demand. So I think that is the problem here. I mean, of course, fans are, if it's an artist they really love, of course they're desperate to go, of course they're desperate to pay. Some will pay over the odds. But, again, I think ticket pricing, it's not an exact art, but I know, most of the managers who I know, again, it's something that they put a lot of time and effort in thinking about, in terms of, what price do you price your tickets? Obviously, you've got to make money, you've got to pay your crew, yada, yada, yada. But, you also want your shows to be accessible and inclusive. So there's a real balance to be struck there.
What is your advice, Adam, finally, to fans in the UK as they wait for this potentially to kick in and become law there?
Probably push your MPs to let's get this legislation, let's get on the, get on the roller coaster and start this legislative process. Because again, we have something called a King's Speech, which marks the start of the kind of the next cycle of legislative program. And if we can get this legislation into that process next, I think it will probably start next March and April. It's probably going to be another year and a half before a law pops out at the end of the process. So there's still a lot of time for touts to exploit, genuine fans. If we miss that opportunity and this legislation doesn't go into the King's Speech, then, we're looking at another few years down the line where, again, this exploitation, this cycle of exploitation will continue. And again, we are talking about hundreds of millions of pounds, which is being displaced from the back pockets of fans to offshore websites via Google and StubHub. And a lot of the scalpers that operate on those sites are also based offshore as well. So, it's money that's leaving our creative economy, leaving the back pockets of fans, and it's flowing into those areas.
I'm glad we could speak, Adam. Thank you.
You are welcome.
Adam Webb is the campaign manager of the Fanfare Alliance. We reached him in London. Earlier this month, the Best Friends Animal Sanctuary in Kanab, Utah, got a call its staff will never forget. A young great horned owl had been discovered inside a cement mixer, and it was now covered in hardened cement. Sierra Medlin is the small animal manager at the sanctuary. That's where we reached her.
Sierra, who was on the other end of that call?
So it was our Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, one of our state officers, that called about this owl that had fallen into a cement mixer.
I mean, just that sentence. Someone saying that I knew what we were going to talk about and it's still surprising. You did not expect that call. What did you think?
We did not. That was definitely a new case for us. Looking back at our history of intakes, that is a brand new intake reason for our facility. And we actually reached out to several other rehabilitation centers, and they also had not had a case like that. So it was very new for everyone.
And so when the owl got to you, when you were able to check him out, what kind of shape was he in?
He was in pretty rough shape. He was very lethargic and not very responsive. And the cement was covering about 25% of his body, mostly on the right wing, along with a little bit on the body and the face as well. So it was a little intimidating of how to handle that situation.
How does a young great horned owl show its discomfort to you?
For us, the physical discomfort was that right wing was heavily drooped, mm-hmm. and he had some trouble standing, and his eyes just weren't very responsive to our movements. So those were some pretty big physical indicators that he wasn't doing that well. And also he wasn't showing any defensive posturing or clacking at us. So he was overall just pretty quiet and reserved.
And do you have any sense at this stage how this owl ended up in a cement mixer in the first place?
We don't. We've kind of been racking our brains on possibilities. We do think he is a young owl, so it could be that he tried to land on the cement mixer. It was moving, and he got off balance and fell in. We're not quite sure.
And who found the owl initially?
It was someone there on site. It was a construction site. So we were never in contact with the original finder. They contacted our State Department of Wildlife Resources, and then they reached out to us.
I mean, the what could have beens if they didn't get to the owl quickly enough also must be going through everybody's mind. But you mentioned you called around. No one has dealt with this before. So how did you even begin? How did you help him?
So we definitely worked as a team, coming up with different treatment strategies. We're very fortunate that we have a veterinary team on staff. So we immediately reached out to one of our exotic veterinarians, and we just came up with a treatment plan of the priority needed to be to get that concrete off so that he could stand correctly and start to heal. So we came up with the plan of doing some sedated, what we called cleaning sessions. And we would sedate him for about 15 to 20 minutes at a time, monitoring his vitals and breathing and making sure that he was stable. And then we had a team of staff that were working quickly to moisten the concrete. We were using toothbrushes, mascara wands, things that were very delicate mm-hmm. to help wash that off without causing more damage to the feathers.
And how long, you know, given that you did it in these short stints to let the owl rest, how long did it take, the whole process?
It actually only took about 5 to 6 sessions. Once we kind of got the routine down and the rhythm, as soon as he was sedated, we went to work and had multiple people working. So it was pretty efficient.
How many days in total?
About 6 days total of actually doing the treatment.
And how is he doing now?
Great. Really pleased with his progress. We were able to get him cleaned up, and he has moved out to one of our 40-foot aviaries that's in a secluded place away from humans as much as possible. And he's perching well. He is flying really well, which is great to see.
Is he looking at all of you lovingly? I know it doesn't work that way, but
I know. We wish. We like to think that he is.
So ultimately, your plan is to release him into the wild. What are you looking and listening for to know that he's ready for that?
The biggest thing is that owls are reliant on completely silent flight in order to catch their prey. So that's really a vital thing that they need to have for release. And right now he does, with the damage from the cement, he's making kind of a whoosh sound as he flies by. So what we're waiting for right now is for him to molt those flight feathers and to grow in new feathers, and then he should be good to go.
But if things don't go as planned, if they're still whooshing, then what?
There are some alternatives. One thing is a process called feather imping, and that is where you can actually remove the current feathers, and you can get already molted feathers from previous owls that match up, and you can surgically replace them. So it's a pretty intense procedure, but that is a backup option should we need it.
Hopefully it won't get to that point. Are you now, Sierra, with your team, putting together a manual so that everyone knows what to do if this happens again?
Yes, we will add this to our list of pre-planned protocols.
Sierra.
Hopefully we won't see it again, though.
I hope so, too. I hope you're right about that. Sierra, I'm glad we could speak, and I'm glad the owl is doing better now. Thank you.
Yes, of course. Thank you for reaching out to us.
Sierra Medlin is the small animal manager at the Best Friends Animal Sanctuary. She's in Kanab, Utah. Now it's time for Hollywood Roundup. I'm Chip Baxter. Today's top story, reinventing the wheel of cheese. Tinseltown is expecting grated things now that the United Talent Agency has signed a huge Italian star. If you're a fan of foreign fare, you already know this legend by name, Parmigiano Reggiano. A sexy celeb known for being well-rounded, if sometimes a little salty. And look out, La La Land, Parmigiano has a history of canoodling, emphasis on noodle. That's it. That's it for the music. I have like 8 more cheese jokes. They have to be done in the Chip Baxter voice. Well, maybe it's for the best. The Parmigiano-Reggiano Consortium, or PRC, has issued an excited statement. It says that Hollywood's United Talent Agency, or UTA, has just signed Parmesan cheese as a client. You may wonder what that means. Well, it means UTA will, quote, leverage its expertise in global connectivity across entertainment and culture to introduce Parmigiano-Reggiano to a wide pool of partners to further its message of gastronomical excellence and high-quality ingredients, production, and distribution, unquote. Now, of course, you already know about the cheese, and UTA hasn't even started leveraging its expertise in global connectivity across entertainment and culture yet. So get ready for some egregious product placement. Wheels of Parmesan used as weapons in action movies, doctors eating Parmesan mid-surgery in medical dramas, and maybe even someone grating Parmesan onto someone else's abs in a love scene in what will be one of many examples of gratuitous nudity. Here's Geoffroy with mac and cheese.
Must be part of a dream, feels like some kind of movie scene. Like I'm just scratching the surface. No, there's more here to witness for me. I'm that bird on the wire who I aspire you to be. Ain't wanna get tired. If you are, it's fine by me. I'm all the type to be loose, loosened up enough for it. Can't remind me what's the use in setting myself limits. Ooh, I'm on the upside.
With mac and cheese.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, NVIDIA is a $5 trillion company. It is also inextricably linked to the explosion in AI. A business reporter tells us whether the AI boom is getting ready to go bust.
And the province of Ontario wants impaired drivers who kill parents to pay child support. Our guest says that would really have helped his son's family after he was killed. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
I'm on the upside.
Thanks for listening to As It Happens here on People Powered KAXC. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Mike Berry, your volunteer host for On the River. He'll bring you a great mix of music. And 10 o'clock, Kari Hedlund with Headwaters. More great music. Support comes from Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. And support comes from the Timber Lake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m., offering guests martinis and menu items such as chicken Kiev, a Reuben, or fettuccine Alfredo. The dinner menu and additional information available at timberlakelodgehotel.com. Minnesota State Parks offer free admission on Friday, November 28th, the day after Thanksgiving. Get out and explore your favorite park or find somewhere new.
Billions of dollars are riding on one question. Is the AI boom just beginning, or is it a bubble that's ready to pop? A lot of people look to the company NVIDIA to see which way the winds are blowing. It makes chips crucial to AI development, and just weeks ago it became the first company to reach a market value of $5 trillion. But this week came headlines indicating that Peter Thiel and SoftBank had sold off their NVIDIA holdings, fueling a rare 2025 stock market dip in recent days. But here's another but. After the markets closed late this afternoon, NVIDIA released its much-anticipated projections for fourth-quarter earnings of $65 billion, exceeding analysts' expectations. Luke Kawa is the markets editor for Sherwood News. We reached him in New York shortly after NVIDIA made its earnings public.
Luke, you've taken a look at the numbers. Is this what you were expecting to see from NVIDIA today?
NVIDIA, we all know, has been such a dominant player for a while. It's tough to keep growing at such a high rate when you've been growing at such a high rate. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this is the first time its annual revenue growth has accelerated in six quarters. So yes, I find that bit a positive surprise there in terms of how well it's done on the top line for sure. So far, I would say this is a bit of a calm and blanket reassurance on the state of the AI trade in general, is how traders have been interpreting these results.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because this earnings report was seen as sort of an indicator of whether or not there might be an AI bubble. Lots of coverage and concern in recent weeks about whether that is coming. We have these numbers. Is this really enough information to tell us if this is actually not a bubble? I mean, can you say that now? Is it safe to say that now?
Oh, absolutely not. The ability of NVIDIA to sell more chips tells you nothing about what in the future the value of those chips will be. All this really tells us is that, in particular, I would say there were starting to be some creeping worries about NVIDIA's ability to deliver and meet high demand. Last quarter, for instance, its data center revenues, which of course are the fastest growing and the most important now part of its business, those actually missed expectations. So what this is telling us right now is at least that NVIDIA has gone through perhaps a period of some supply kerfuffles as it has built out its Blackwell supply chain, and it's now doing a lot better in terms of getting those into the hands of customers who are utilizing them. NVIDIA, its demand, it's sold out effectively through 2026 already. So the question of NVIDIA sales are not going to be telling you much. What might tell you much in terms of whether there's an AI bubble or not is a lot more of the downstream information in terms of whether companies are adopting this more and what kind of savings or efficiencies they're generating down the road.
The cautionary things you're putting out there for people to listen to, it doesn't seem to be reflected, though, in the after-hours trading you were talking about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not. Hey, at a certain point, I think we've had a lot of, I would say, lately, more nuanced interpretation of how AI is doing lately. So I would say there's been also a bit of a deflation in more speculative stocks. And those stocks are really what are now also getting lifted from this rising tide from NVIDIA's results. So again, really do think that the prime takeaway so far, early on at least, is that this is giving the green light to re-engage with all parts of the AI boom.
How interconnected these players are in the AI financial world, it's worrying to a lot of people, that interconnectedness, that reliance. Is that troubling from where you sit?
In one way, yes, it is troubling. In the other way, I think it makes sense for all the players involved, and this is why they're doing this. So, for instance, if you're NVIDIA and you're looking at the state of the world, what you want, the perfect world dreaming 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, is you want as many people as possible buying as many of the latest versions of your chips as possible and continuing to be successful and generate returns with them. So the idea that you're effectively, by either, you know, investing in them often, subsidizing demand, subsidizing the cost of those chips, that does two things. First of all, it's giving those smaller players probably their best possible chance of success. And also, it's keeping demand for your own products very high so that the headline price that you have and the ability to have demand continuing to outstrip supply, that continues longer than it otherwise would. So in other words, I would say this is kind of it's a maximalist play. It's something that increases the potential success if everything breaks right, but it also increases the potential downside if everything starts to fall apart. So it's a rational move. Understand why it's happening. But, you know, that in and of itself is certainly something that raises the potential volatility in terms of how much an AI bust, if and when we do ever get one, would weigh on markets broadly and the economy as well.
People may remember The Big Short, the book and the film, and an investor featured in that is Michael Burry. He profited big time, you know, seeing the 2008 housing bubble before other people did. He's making the same kinds of predictions about NVIDIA and AI now. Do you think he has it right or wrong this time around?
One thing that Michael Burry has highlighted is this idea that, in his view, the value of these chips that people are buying now, they should be going down fairly quickly because new chips are getting introduced. And in his view, that should be making these older chips obsolete. Well, my answer to that would be, look at the Florida Panthers. We can go to hockey now. Look at the Florida Panthers. Look at picking up Brad Marchand. Was he in his prime when they did it? No. Did it help them win a Stanley Cup? Absolutely. So I would somewhat dismiss that part of the thesis in a very narrow sense. But I think he does raise an interesting question of, okay, what does happen if down the road you don't see these investments bearing fruit in terms of how much revenues companies are going to generate? Well, that would mean that not only are how much you're willing to spend on these chips, that's probably going to go down, but you would also see older chips lose a lot of value. And why that would be concerning is that there's quite a few companies who have been able to raise debt, and the collateral they're putting up for that debt is the value of these chips, which are getting older. So those companies in particular, which are on the more marginal fringes of the ecosystem, could be under a lot of stress, and that could really accelerate quickly in the event that there is a turn in AI.
Luke, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Luke Kawa is the markets editor for Sherwood News. We reached him in New York today, shortly after NVIDIA released its quarterly earnings report. The Alberta government seems to really be developing a taste for invoking the clause. It used to be rare and controversial for a province to use the Charter's notwithstanding clause, which overrides federally protected rights to stop a law from being quashed in the courts. But now Alberta Premier Daniel Smith has used it twice in a month, this time to ensure legislation regarding transgender youth cannot be overturned. The laws limit gender-affirming care, ban trans girls from taking part in amateur female sport, and require parental consent for kids under 16 who want to change their names or pronouns at school. Amelia Newbert is the managing director of the Skipping Stone Foundation, which was challenging two of those laws.
Even when you know something's coming, just to see it introduced was a bit of a gut punch. To see the government celebrating the introduction of the legislation, when I contrast that with the dozens of families that we're supporting every day, and looking at these families crying and just sort of trying to hold their children and find a way through it, I think it just speaks to the callousness and of this legislation.
How are those families you're supporting, how are they affected by yesterday's news?
When we look at many of the youth who are looking to access either gender-affirming care or looking to just have a sense of belonging, whether it's like in schools or in sports, to go really quickly from a province where youth and families feel like they're being welcomed within the province. And, we've seen this legislation kind of be pushed through. And now all of those things that families were looking forward to around making sure their youth can thrive, whether it's like in schools, whether it's accessing gender-affirming care, we're, just seeing and feeling with all of those families as those things get ripped away. And as the things that kiddos need to be able to flourish and thrive are literally being torn away from them. And I don't know how you explain that to children.
On the kind of legal and practical side of this, and I appreciate you sharing all that, what you were successful in getting an injunction placed on the gender-affirming healthcare law. Does that injunction and any legal challenge you have end once this bill passes?
Certainly from our stance as an organization, we will pursue any avenue we can to continue fighting this. But as far as we know, and as far as we're looking at it right now, yes, it would supersede any of the kind of battles we're having in court, and this would kind of supersede the injunction. And so all of those laws would come into full effect.
Amelia Newbert is the managing director of Alberta's Skipping Stone Foundation. She was talking to Lauren McGinnis, host of the Calgary Eye Opener. When someone is killed by an impaired driver, there is, of course, the immediate grief. But then, when that person was a main provider, there's the reality of paying the bills and raising the family left behind. Now the Ontario government says it has a solution for that: child support. The government says it's looking into the possibility of forcing impaired drivers who are convicted of killing a parent to pay a monthly fee to the child until they turn 18. Bob Caro's son Robert was killed by an impaired driver in 2020 while he was out for a run. He left behind his wife and four children. Mr. Caro is now the president of MAD Toronto, and that's where we reached him.
Bob, what do you make of this proposal? Do you see it as a way to get some kind of justice for families like yours?
I do think, I'm not sure about the word justice. There is nothing that could happen in the justice system that would bring my son back. So it's not a term I use, but I would say I think it's a good step in, as we can all imagine, what happened to his spouse in particular was needless and criminal and sudden, and left her in a very, very difficult position with four children, not just emotionally but financially.
This is your daughter-in-law. How old were their children, your grandchildren, at the time?
They were 14 to 19, four children, yes.
So what kinds of realities, financial realities, was your daughter-in-law dealing with?
Well, you've got four kids that we all know it's a very expensive time in our lives as our children are entering college and university. And I think we all want our children to go on. So that was still her desire. It would have been Rob's desire. And suddenly one of the breadwinners in the house, a major breadwinner, is gone, and that income is gone. And so it's a scary future.
And, you know, there's insurance in cases like these. How does right. that help? How would this add to that or potentially fill a gap for a need that's right. not being met?
So there is insurance, and I would say we never, you probably haven't thought about it. I hadn't thought about it until it occurred, but it really isn't sufficient when you think somebody like Rob, who was 43, would have been working for, say until he was 65, another 22 years. Mm-hmm. 22 years of income, and, you know, at escalating with the cost of index, isn't captured by the insurance claim. So it's not enough. I think certainly if there was a responsibility assigned to the perpetrator to assist going forward, I think that would do two things. I think it would seem appropriate, given the damages that they caused, that they would, and damages meaning that you're bringing about a financial hardship that wasn't planned. So that damage would be covered by the perpetrator. And I think maybe going back to your first question about justice, mm-hmm. perhaps that would provide some justice for the perpetrator. I don't know that any of us, if we were to take a life, how your life would look after that. And in this way, perhaps you can make some atonement and carry that accountability.
What kind of consequences did the person who killed your son face?
He had a year probation, a two-year driving ban, and he went to jail for 30 days.
How are you and your family doing now?
Well, we're fortunate. We have, I have four children, and my children all have children. And so as a unit, we're 20. And I think what, largely driven by my wife initially, right out of the gate was, we can't focus on the accident. We can't look back, to that day. So what we do is we look forward, and we support each other. It's a big group, and I would say everybody's doing well, quite well given the circumstances. Nobody could be. You can't leave someone behind crying in their bedroom.
I'm so sorry. For you talked about the things that most of us don't have to think about, mm-hmm. and that you and your family and many other families have had to think about. Right. You're doing this work now that's important to you, clearly. Has that helped mm-hmm. you?
Yes, for me it's cathartic. That I think it's as if Rob is still making a contribution. Yeah. That his story raises awareness, and it's emotional. I think you can hear in my voice, and I think that I recognize that that's also the power in it, is that I think it's relatable when you hear that. And regardless of how many times we'll say the numbers, you know, there's 9 charges an hour, there's, you know, hundreds of people killed every year, there's thousands of people injured, those are all just numbers. And until there's a story attached and a face, and that someone, that's a dad, who's telling a story that sounds emotional, then I think it's relatable. And maybe then we'll stick in the minds of people when you're in a position to make a decision. And you'll plan ahead. You'll think, well, I really don't want to be coming out of the bar tonight and thinking, oh, should I Uber? It's cold. All those things. You plan ahead, yeah. And you remember. Remember Rob. You remember that story. And I think all of us would think, I don't want to be the guy that takes a life. I don't want to be that girl that's driving the car. And something happens and I'm just not 100%. We talk about impairment, but there is any amount of alcohol is impairment. And how would you live with yourself if you took a life and you thought, well, I really wasn't at my best. I may have been faster if I wasn't impaired.
I hope people, wherever they're listening, Bob, are listening carefully and taking to heart what you're saying.
Right.
I appreciate your time. Please take care. Thank you. I know this isn't easy.
Okay. You're welcome. Thank you.
Bob Caro is the president of MAD Toronto, and that's where we reached him. Three times a week, Brenda Lipson teaches a not-so-typical boxing class. It has all the punching and sweating and grunting that you'd expect, but all the students have Parkinson's disease. It's part of a program called Knockout Parkinson's Disease in London, Ontario, that's designed to lessen symptoms. Ms. Lipson says she has seen real results over the last few years, but that just because her class is adaptive does not mean that it's easy.
Every class, we have about 15 to 20 minute warm up. We have a 15 to 20 minute cool down. Then we have strengthening. We might have a coordination segment, a balance segment, and definitely about 40 minutes of boxing. The one thing that a lot of people say to us when they come here with Parkinson's is they didn't know anyone else with the disease, and they also didn't know what they could do. So it's a very positive atmosphere, and we also see some improvement, which is unheard of actually in Parkinson's, so it's pretty exciting to see. Some people will find, we had a fellow come in who could only walk to the end of the driveway with his walker, and he was walking several blocks afterward. We had someone come in with a cane, and they didn't need the cane anymore. We had another gentleman who found that the stretching that we do at the end of the class eliminated his back pain. My husband, who's had Parkinson's for 21 years, is independent with his activities of daily living. He doesn't use a walker, doesn't use a cane, and that's very unusual at 21 years. I have to remind myself, though, that people with Parkinson's are all different. So there are many symptoms they can have, many difficulties they can have. So I have to remind myself it's not necessarily like him. I was a physiotherapist for 44 years as well, so I'm thinking of it from that viewpoint as well, even though I'm retired. But when I see him every day, it helps me to revise the program and devise new things that we maybe haven't done before. I think when people come in this class, they see people who've been here for different lengths of time. My husband's been boxing for 8 years now. And that's a really good motivator for them. Otherwise, a lot of them say, if I was at home, I'd be sitting on the couch. I wouldn't be doing anything. And 20 years ago, as short a time as 20 years ago, people were told, you have Parkinson's disease. It's incurable. It's going to get worse. Go home and get your affairs in order. Well, what does that message does that send? We're the opposite. If you want to do it, let's do it. We might have to modify, but you can do it.
Boxing coach Brenda Lipson talking to the CBC's Alessio Donini.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.